This is a story about the Spitfire. More importantly, perhaps, this is a story about people and the decisions they take. What ordinary people do in extraordinary times, be it disease, revolution, war.
The birds fly a lot better than we do. See how they wheel and bank and glide? Perfect. And all in one. Wings, body, tail, all in one.
Believe me, the Spitfire has got what it takes.
In the summer of 1940, Britain stands alone against the Nazis. Hitler's forces have swept through Europe. They're close enough to shell the English coast. Invasion is imminent, but before the German army can cross the channel from France, they need to wipe out the Royal Air Force. They've been doing a pretty good job so far, destroying airfields and aircraft on the ground and in the air. By August, there is virtually nothing in reserve. The RAF squadrons desperately need new aircraft, particularly the Spitfire, the fastest, most advanced fighter plane in the world. This is Spitfire, the people's plane. The story not of the plane itself, the beautiful aerodynamic fighting marvel. This is the story of the people who chose to risk everything in order to build it. I'm Tuppence Middleton. Over 10 episodes, you'll get to know these ordinary heroes. I'll tell their stories with the help of historians and audio and written archives, including those of the BBC and the Imperial War Museum. But what really matters here, what closes the gap between us and them, are the voices of the real people, lots of them teenagers, young people experiencing for the first time the full force of life and death.
So, tell me how it went with Cyril.
He kind of had two left feet.
Joan Tagg and her best friend Peggy Moon work at the Supermarine Aircraft Factory in Southampton on the south coast of England. It's 1940, the height of the air battle over Britain, and this factory makes the best fighter plane of the Second World War, the Spitfire. That makes Joan and Peggy amongst the number one targets of the most powerful bomber force in the world, the Luftwaffe.
At 18, I was interviewed for the post of shorthand typist in the wages office. Most of my work consisted of typing documents relating to the specification of the Spitfire aircraft supplied to RAF stations. I particularly disliked typing statements for the aircrafts and parts. Each form had to have 6 copies, which meant sheets and sheets of carbon paper. The social side was pleasant. Dances at Southampton Guildhall. The ladies in long dresses and the men in suits, with their hair smothered in Brill cream.
The city of Southampton, on England's south coast, home of the Supermarine Spitfire factory, is really vulnerable. German bombers can reach it, but more importantly, so can their Messerschmitt fighter escorts. This means that the fighters keep the British planes busy, while the bombers have plenty of time to drop their deadly load.
I must admit that I'm getting rather jittery, being constantly on the alert, and I'm also feeling the effects of disturbed nights. Even though the planes may not be overhead, we do hear gunfire and are constantly up and down to the shelter.
The Spitfires are built in 2 factories. They're just a few hundred metres apart on the banks of the River Itchen, across the water from Southampton city centre. On the ground floor of the Woolston plant, there's E shop, where the planes are assembled, P shop, where the wings are made, and K shop, where Cyril Russell works. He's a 19-year-old apprentice. He's just learnt to bend metal panels to be turned into Spitfires.
We pass through the machine shop with its whine, through the calm of the wing shop, and then into a gangway to a sea of benches with men banging and hammering pieces of silver-coloured metal.
Cyril and Joan see each other every Sunday at the Methodist Church, and Cyril carries a torch for Joan's friend, Peggy.
I had quite a crush on her, and we had gone to the Grand Theatre together. She was a secretary and known to the lads as the girl in green because of the smart green outfit she wore with a little fur hat. Her name was Peggy. Peggy Moon from Canada Road, and a lovelier girl one could not wish to know.
Peggy Moon from Canada Road and her friend Joan Tagg went to school together. Joan left a year earlier than Peggy, but they're together again as typists on the 4th floor of the factory's office block.
Tuesday the 13th of August 1940. We are very busy at work and it's becoming difficult to complete everything because of the constant interruptions for air raid alarms. which means frequent dashes to the shelter, which is beside the railway bank and Sea Road, at least 5 minute walk away.
The air raid shelters at Supermarine are 500 metres from Joan and Peggy's office. Skipping down four flights of narrow stairs from the top floor, they run straight into the flow of hundreds of factory floor workers making their own way to the shelters. Once out of the Hazel Road exit, they have to turn up Sea Road Hill, cross under the railway bridge, and sprint across Pear Tree Green. Only then do they reach the shelters.
We had a real air raid this afternoon. We reached the shelters and these were shaking as the planes came over, machine gunning and bombing.
To drown out the sound of the bombs, Joan and her friends play games and sing their favourite songs from the wireless.
Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s. Bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, cos we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl.
Air raid sirens sound every day now. Any sighting of a German aircraft sets off the warning that sends the workers scurrying to the shelters. That means that Spitfire production stops.
5 raids today. Only did 5 hours work. That's a loss of 5 hours.
It's then that Joan's boss makes a frightening announcement.
We have now heard that because so much time is being lost at work, we're only to get the warning to leave when danger is imminent.
Instructions were issued for all works to operate a delayed warning system. This meant that public air raid alarms were ignored and work sirens would be sounded when spotters on the roof saw enemy aircraft approaching.
That gave workers hardly any time to reach the shelters. It's early September now, and there are more and more air raids on Southampton. Factories and dockyards close by are hit by bombs. The tension is almost unbearable.
Monday, the 16th of September. Once more the siren sounded and we rushed to the shelter. Unfortunately, we had to go the long way round as a bomb had fallen on the path to the shelters. I got a tin can caught in my heel, so I was slowed up when climbing the bank.
Joan's friend Peggy has now been transferred to the Itchen Works, the other half of the Spitfire factory. It's closer to the shelters, but no one feels safe.
I am not looking forward to going to work tomorrow. We are so busy and I feel we are likely to be attacked very shortly. I wish they would evacuate us to a safer place. Tuesday, the 24th of September. In the afternoon, without warning, there was terrific gunfire and we rushed to the window. How foolish.
No sirens wail. The immediate danger hooter is silent.
We heard the sounds of planes and the whine of bombs and saw all the staff fall to the floor underneath the desks, bosses and all. Found myself laughing. We tried to make our way to the ground floor, but the stairs were blocked with those too frightened to venture forth.
I heard this terrible roaring. I can't describe really what it was like. It was just a great solid roar. And you know, we all looked at each other absolutely horrified.
That's the first warning I had, anything was wrong, because I heard a gun go off and I was up in the tail of a Spitfire. And of course I come out of there like a jackrabbit, made my way to the shelters. And that's when all hell seemed to let loose.
There was anti-aircraft fire and bombs just dropping. And it just all merged into one sound. And above the sound of the bombs, you could hear the roar of the aircraft. It was really quite horrific. And we were all petrified.
You've got to know the sound of German bombers. They had that most distinctive note coming across, and you could tell they were heavily laden because you could hear this whoom, 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 whoom. And then as soon as they dropped their bombs, it was whoom, 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 and away they went. And we sat just waiting, crunched up and praying that what they'd let go was going to go somewhere else and not onto us.
I said, God's truth, the truth, I'm sat here. I see those bombs fall out of the plane. Day like that, stick of bombs, and that was it, and they was away. Terrible, though, to kill people like that.
I looked up and to my left, and there they were, with the bombs already leaving their wrecks. The exploding bombs made the ground tremble and kick, and for a moment or so, although it seemed longer, there was just nothing I could do.
terrible. No, I don't think anybody's brave, not during bombing. They say, well, some of them think they are, but I wasn't brave, I was frightened. I was terrified after that, when I used to... After I got buried in the shelter, I used to dread. Yeah, I used to be really frightened of hearing those bombers.
When there was a lull, we managed to get out and rush to the shelters, but found to our horror that many of them had been hit. We could only stand and stare in horror as the stretcher bearers staggered by us with the dead and injured.
The factories got off lightly. The bombs had missed their target, but 42 people died and 63 were seriously injured, many buried in the shoddy shelters or caught in the open as they ran for cover.
My friend Peggy had been one of those killed sheltering beneath the railway bridge. We had on the previous Saturday attended a friend's wedding, and I walked home with Peggy talking about our favourite songs. Peggy's favourite was Begin the Beguine. I felt very trembly and could not believe it had all happened.
My foreman came over to me and told me quietly that one girl had been killed. It was the girl in green. Peggy. Peggy Moon.
The next day, smoke still drifts from the flattened old fishermen's cottages behind the factory, but Joan and Cyril are back at work, and the Spitfire parts are being dipped, bent, moulded and assembled on the factory floor.
Thursday the 26th of September. Peaceful morning. Managed to catch up on my pile of invoices. We went across the road to the canteen for our tea, and I was just raising the cup to my lips when the immediate danger hooter blasted out.
Geoffrey Wheeler is a local history guide in Southampton. His father was a policeman during the raids, and his uncles worked in the factory.
Third time on the 26th of September, they got it right, as far as they were concerned. They sent some Heinkels, which were specially equipped for bombing with bombing sights on, and also the Messerschmitt 110s. They sent several squadrons over, and they came up Southampton Water and turned down the River Itchen and came across exactly where we're standing now, on top of us. Didn't drop any bombs on the John I. Thornycroft, started dropping them here, and they carpet bombed. If you can imagine, laying a big carpet right across here.
I was met with the sight of the factory in ruins under a pall of dust and smoke. The canteen was in flames.
When the all clear sounds, Joan crawls from the shelter and bumps into her father, rushing towards the factory. He'd been told that Supermarine was in ruins. 120 German planes attacked Southampton that day. 55 people were killed, and Spitfire production ground to a sudden halt. As each British fighter was shot from the sky, there would be nothing to replace it. The bare bones of the last of the aircraft were crushed amongst the smoke and twisted metal of the factory. As the shell-shocked workers picked their way through the ruins, there was a small glimmer of hope.
Wolston Works was hit by about 7 bombs, but it looked much worse than it was. They didn't actually get through to the machine tools.
News of the raid and detail of the damage reached government headquarters in London before the German Heinkels and Messerschmitts even turned for home.
When the air raid warning went, 2 volunteers from the workforce would get into this metal Dalek and stay there while the bombs were being dropped so they could report the damage.
Max Aitken, Lord Beaverbrook, the Minister for Aircraft Production, took the call in Whitehall, jumped in his chauffeur-driven car and sped straight down to Southampton. Beaverbrook knows Britain's air defences are at breaking point. He needs to survey the damage for himself.
That evening, Lord Beaverbrook arrived here at the works, and I was sent for with other people to see this wizened-faced little man. And he thumped the table and said, "Look, I want more Spitfires, more Spitfires."
That's works engineer Len Gooch. His team was battered and bruised, but they do have something to offer Beaverbrook. The factory is a clear and obvious target, So why not move the machinery out to places the Germans couldn't spot? The idea catches Max's imagination.
So they told Beaverbrook about it, and he said, fine, do that now, but I want you to take a radius of 50 miles, and I want you to move all the production out there.
It's an extraordinary idea. In Germany, the great rival to the Spitfire, the Messerschmitt 109, is being built in just 4,000 man-hours by specialist teams on a state-of-the-art production line, three times faster than the bombed Southampton factories. Max Beaverbrook now has a very different handmade vision. Production of the Spitfire must restart immediately, but not in a city centre factory. It will be dispersed, hidden amongst towns and villages. Hidden amongst the very people the Spitfire is supposed to protect. It will be a change that breaks every rule of modern industry and places thousands of new workers right in the heart of the battle. No one quite knows how it will work, but the promise is made.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. Invasion by land and sea, but principally by the air. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger? By industry, by enterprise, by endurance, and by fortitude. And here let me say that all those engaged in the production of aircraft have demonstrated a vast measure of industry and endurance. It is our task to assure the pilots that the supply is adequate to necessities and worthy of the men who fly for Britain over the land and over the sea.
New factories need to be set up, new workers need to be trained, and as we'll hear in the next episode of Spitfire, millions of pounds have to be raised from the public. The Spitfire becomes the people's plane. Funded by the people, built by the people, to protect the people.
We have arrived in the promised land.
The story of the founding of Israel.
The kibbutz grows and grows behind its watchtowers. How can our village survive?
A podcast drama from the BBC World Service.
If we get what we want, there will be war. If we don't, there will be war.
Miriam.
We have so much in common. We belong here like anyone else.
And Yusuf.
All I can see from here are your fences. All I can hear is your pipes pumping our wells dry.
Two stories.
No! Let it burn! Like tinder!
One shared history.
We have come to kill us!
Kill us! How has that happened?
Miriam and Yusuf. Search for Miriam and Yusuf. That's M-I-R-I-A-M and Y-O-U-S-S-E-F. Wherever you get your podcasts.